Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge Mini Episode Number 389. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. We have a very interesting guest with us here today. He's got some perspectives to speak about that it's going to make for a different kind of a segment than what we've had on the show previously because of this man's life experiences, everything that he has been through. And it will be, I think, a very enlightening conversation. And again, as folks know who have been listening to the show over a period of time, I personally am a lifelong observant Roman Catholic and have my perspectives that I'm coming from. So it'll be very interesting. I'm looking forward to, after we go through some of this gentleman's biography and some of the things he's been up to recently, some of the projects he's been working on, taking a sort of philosophical turn at the end here and seeing just how unbridgeable different perspectives may be. I know that they are unbridgeable to an extent, but I definitely would like to take a philosophical turn with this gentleman and kind of engage him on that and find out just exactly how unbridgeable different perspectives may be. It's, again, characteristic of what we like to do in the FDH Lounge, break it all down on this program, get into it. And, again, this is a very interesting gentleman to speak with. He is a former NFL player and NFL Europe player. He is executive director of the You Can Play Project, and he has been one of a number recently of advisors to Michael Sam, as he has dealt with his experience of coming out and coming into the NFL draft, and he had an opportunity to meet with Michael Sam along with some other folks. So always very newsworthy projects that he is working on, and looking forward to getting a chance to speak with this gentleman. I speak, of course, of Wade Davis. Wade, welcome to the FDH Lounge. Sir, how are you today?
I'm wonderful. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks. At, I guess let's just start there. Let's start with the rip from the headline stuff and maybe kind of work our way backwards. But I know you had that meeting with Michael Sam recently. You wrote about it and your experience of getting to talk to him, and I know that you're very impressed with him personally. So what has it been like as somebody who was gay and in the NFL, albeit closeted, but what is it like dealing with this gentleman and seeing what he's going through and getting ready to come in as an openly gay man from day one?
I've been, as you mentioned, very fortunate to have a chance to meet Michael Sam. And the one thing that you realize from the moment that you're in his presence is that he's a very thoughtful guy who is really just someone who's gay but wants to continue his lifelong dream as a football player. As he said in his combine interview, you know, he really wants to be thought of as a football player that happens to be gay, instead of a gay football player. And I think that the work that I'm doing, the work that's been being done by a lot of other people, you know, who's associated with LGBT activism in sports, and also I think the country in general wants to just move past this conversation and just speak about him as an athlete who happens to be gay instead of a gay athlete.
Well, before I have another question to ask you about him, but I just want to follow up on what you were saying there. How long do you think that basically takes to where this is less noteworthy? I mean, clearly the next person will be less noteworthy in terms of media attention than the person after that, but to where it becomes more commonplace and commonly understood that it's going on and that there aren't just a few folks out there that are the noted exceptions to the rule, how long do you think that takes?
I don't think that there's a time frame on that. I think it depends on the number of athletes who are in the four major sports who just start to come out and announce themselves as being gay. Because, you know, if the next 5 years no other athlete comes out and then another one does, it'll be kind of just as big of a story. So I think it'll depend on whether myself and other people are doing the type of work that creates an environment where players feel more safe and comfortable to come out.
Well, in terms of Michael Sam, the other question I wanted to ask you about this is there's an issue completely unrelated from this in terms of how he's going to fit onto a football team, and that being, And I can say, as somebody who's a very close NFL draft observer year in and year out, some questions about system here. Is he more of a 4-3 guy? Is he more of a 3-4 kind of a guy? And that may inform where he goes in the draft and if he perhaps goes a little bit later than some people may think. Is that something you're going to be keeping an eye out on? And like, okay, are these teams just using this as an excuse for not taking him? Or is that something where you would see that as a legitimate reason possibly for passing on him, at least in the earlier rounds?
Well, I'm a firm believer that the NFL is a business, and if a team feels that Michael Sam can help them win, then they're going to draft him. You know, I've been involved with sports enough to know that teams just aren't going to draft you or not draft you if they feel that you can or can't help. You know, Michael Sam, there's been enough analysis on his type of game, you know, whether he can fit in as a 3-4 rusher or can he be more of a specialized third down type of guy on a 4-3 team. So I think it's really going to depend on a team's needs. I don't believe that there'll be teams that'll pass on him because he's gay. I think teams will pass on him or take him, as I said before, if they feel like that he can come in and help them. You know, he was a star player in the SEC, which is, for lack of a better term, like the minor leagues of the NFL. So if he can be a good player there, there's no doubt in my mind that he can be a good player in the NFL. But he's just like all players; he's going to need to be in the right system. You know, I was a cornerback that played a lot of man to man. So when I came into the league, the last thing I wanted to be was a cover two corner because it just didn't fit my skill set. So I think it's going to all depend on system and whether or not the team that he gets drafted by is a good fit for him as an athlete.
That's my sense of it as well, that he's going to get drafted where he does for football reasons, because, again, these picks, particularly the high to middle ones, are far too precious for teams to do anything other than football reasons. So that would be my sense as well for where he goes or doesn't go. But in terms of what he is going to deal with there, it's a different climate from where it was a little bit over a decade ago when you were in the NFL and NFL Europe, and you've written about your experiences of feeling the pressure that you felt to try to fit in and, again, to act hetero, whatever that means as far as putting out public perception. And I'm curious from your perspective, in looking back on it, how much of that do you think was internalized and how much of it do you think was actual stuff? Was there a lot of cases of people saying or doing things that were kind of innocuous that you took as, oh, crap, this guy might be on to me? Or how much of that was basically in your head versus actual things you were dealing with from people?
To be honest with you, a lot of, for myself, is that I dealt with so much internalized homophobia and shame that when I got into high school and more even in college and in the pros, I already had these kind of narratives and understanding of what people's perception of me already was. So I never felt like I couldn't be out on my team, or not, that's not true. I didn't feel that my teammates were creating an environment where I couldn't announce my sexuality as being gay. But what I did feel is that it would have made people look at me very differently. You know, there are specific kind of scripts, you know, back when I was playing, and to some extent now, that people assume that gay men are. You know, we often thought of as being weaker, being less than, being more like a woman, which speaks to not only a culture of homophobia, but mainly sexism, right? So the last thing that I wanted was for someone to equate my manhood with being something that was less of your stereotypical man. So a lot of it was something that I had learned, you know, as a kid about what it meant to be gay. And, you know, I tell people this often that if you're a player who's not out in high school, you're not going to come out in college, and you're not going to come out in the NFL unless there is a big shift in the society and culture, or that there's something that happens with you. So I'm always trying to explain to people that the NFL is not this place where players can't be openly gay. It's something that they're working through on their own. It's something that I was trying to work through on their own. And the society that you exist in, that you grow up in, really dictates how safe or how comfortable you feel to announce your sexuality.
Well, I wonder how much of it also, too, again, you were dealing with a little bit of a different climate a little bit over a decade ago. Plus, I wonder how much of it has to do with the caste system of the NFL. A good friend of mine and a good friend of the show's Vernon Turner, like yourself, was an undrafted free agent. So to do this from that perspective where you're on the bubble from day one, and again, it takes a long time, if ever, for a lot of guys to get off of that bubble, versus Michael Sam is going to come in realistically probably a mid-round pick at worst. But again, as somebody who was an award-winning player in the SEC, comes in with that kind of profile on the football field, I would imagine it's much more difficult for somebody to assert themselves if they're a guy who's afraid that they may not make the roster in the first place versus somebody who has a pretty good sense that they're going to make it regardless.
Definitely. You know, one of the things that the word is thrown around oftentimes is the word of a distraction, right? And there are plenty of people who hate that type of word. They're assuming that Michael Sam is a distraction because he's LGBT, right? Michael Sam could be selling books, you know, in the back of the locker room. And if that is a distraction, you know, it's a business, and teams want players to just be basically focusing on the sport of football. So so one of the things that we're really trying to do is get the media to understand that, hey, this guy's gay, but can you focus on the football, because that's the most important. So if you're a marginal guy like myself and you are deemed a distraction, then there's less of a chance that a team is going to want to deal with that type of a distraction. You know, but if you're a guy who's drafted first, second, third, or fourth round, then teams actually know what they're getting into. You know, they're prepping for that, and they're willing to put players through, you know, the team and the players and the coaches to have to answer certain questions. You know, I'll use the Terrell Owens example. When he was a top five receiver, he was a distraction, and the team, they put up with it. But as soon as his productivity dropped, the distraction became not worth what it was just because of his playing level. So he couldn't get on the team anymore. So players have to kind of weigh the type of a distraction that they're gonna be, you know, because that'll dictate whether or not a team will say, okay, I'm going to take this kid, Wade Davis, in the seventh round or a free agent, knowing that his value added may not be enough for me to want to deal with the distraction.
Distractions do come in many forms. That is certainly true. And players, as you said, can manifest that in a lot of different ways. In terms of, again, the chronological, the trajectory of when you came into the league historically versus Michael Sam, this is a discussion I've had with some people previously, just kind of doing a little bit of social science and kind of looking at society over a period of time. I'm curious to see if you agree with this assertion, but I really think as far as, again, evolving societal attitudes on gays and lesbians, I really think that first the show Ellen had a lot to do with that, and then Will and Grace. That Ellen was somebody who had really kind of ingratiated herself into kind of mainstream society before anybody knew for sure where she was at sexually, and then she came out and had that kind of pre-existing attachment to her in the show Will and Grace, which I think, you know, portrayed gays and lesbians in a certain way as well. My sense is that those programs around the turn of the century, maybe a little bit before, but it's been kind of building even since then, and there's been more programming like that, and that's had a lot to do with the conditioning that people have gone through. Do you kind of share that the entertainment industry and TV programs in particular have had a lot to do with this?
Yes, 100%. You know, I say this often, that the visibility of LGBT people is the advocacy, is what does a great job of educating people, you know, and it takes us from the shadows into the public light. So, you know, even a show like Modern Family, you know, by being such a show that has so many viewers, really helps people to reimagine and helps them to reshape their ideas around what it means to be gay. One of the things that those shows haven't done a good job of, and the entertainment industry hasn't done a good job of, is really nuancing or showing different types of LGBT people, right? You know, there is still this stereotypical gay man that shows up on television, you know, or this very stereotypical lesbian woman. So, you know, over the next 5 to 10 to 15 years, I would hope that we start to show a different, you know, the spectrum of what it means to be gay, similar to the spectrum of what it means to be heterosexual.
Well, this probably goes back to a little bit of what we were talking about before as far as when you were playing and the pressure to kind of act stereotypically heterosexual, again, whatever that means. I've noticed a lot of the same thing you're talking about as well with characters. One of the things, I don't know if you've seen this or not, but on the new sitcom this year, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, They have a gay character on there who I think is presented in a pretty matter-of-fact kind of way, and that there's nothing aside from the fact that you know that he's gay and that he has said that would cause you to understand it. This is not like a Sean Hayes situation where everything about the man screams stereotype. This character is one that I think probably would be mistaken for straight in a lot of different parlances here. So is that kind of more what you're talking about as far as characters that don't necessarily wear that on their sleeves?
Exactly. You know, and again, you know, I'm a type of man, you know, for lack of a better word, that has what I like to call masculine privilege, right? Which means that I can enter and exit spaces without someone assuming my sexuality. But making sure that we see different representations of what it means to be LGBT is really important. And that, again, helps people to realize that we're not this one type of monolithic gay person. So a show like Brooklyn Nine-Nine that has a gay male like that on there really helps people to reimagine it.
So you have seen that show? You're familiar with the character?
I am not familiar with the character, but I don't watch a lot of TV.
Oh, okay.
You know, but
okay.
Yeah, you know, I watch ESPN incessantly and some news shows, but other than that, I don't watch much television.
Okay. All right, yeah, that I don't even watch the show that much, but it's something that I noticed from coming across it once or twice. But, again, as I had indicated in the setup here, something I would like to – I've never heard somebody from my perspective – pose a philosophical question to someone of your perspective before, so making a little bit of history here, perhaps. But again, as I had indicated, just in terms of the setup here, that again, I am a lifelong Roman Catholic. I am a social conservative. I have my thoughts on that, and we need not elaborate anything, you know, further on that. But everybody basically understands the perspective, I think, of religious traditionalists and the like, and. There's this sense that I have that, again, there's the divide as far as the perspectives and what's the best application of love thy fellow man. So I'm going to basically look at the universe here of, let's just take this universe of people who are truly well-meaning. And let's leave aside anybody else who has, you know, any bigoted thoughts or is not a well-meaning kind of a person. But the analogy that I make in looking at this, we all understand in life that you essentially have two kinds of friends, right? You have the kind of friend, you know, person A is somebody who cheers you on no matter what you do and backs you unconditionally and doesn't stop to, okay, is that such a great idea? Is it not? Person B is actually the kind of friend that I am, of where I do sometimes stick my neck out. Sometimes my friends don't like it, but generally they appreciate that, you know, I try to look out for them. I'm willing to, you know, risk the heat a little bit. And, again, that applies also, I think, to my perspective on looking at issues like this. And I think, again, social conservatives who are well-meaning people and who truly have nothing but love in their hearts for people, in the sense that, again, the most important thing from the perspective of any social conservative would be the human soul, the fact that our lifetime here on Earth is basically one grain of sand, if you will, on that entire vast beach. And that basically, in terms of trying to look out for their fellow man, even if it means saying something that's unpopular, something that's not very well appreciated, et cetera. And to me, I don't see the straight allies, the progressives of the movement, essentially having that same kind of concern. They seem to be okay with, okay, well, we'll take our chances on the mercy of God, versus I would say that the social conservatives like myself, again, since the notion of the mercy of God, we don't exactly know how that comes down. I see a lot of social conservatives like myself who adhere to the same kind of traditional beliefs as not wanting to take that chance with somebody else's soul. So from your perspective, is there anything at all that you get about that? I understand it's not anything that you would embrace as a philosophy, because it would basically mean renouncing the entire path that you're on. But is there anything about that even intellectually on any level that makes sense as far as a perspective?
You gave me a lot there. I'm just trying to tease out what the actual question is. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. In terms of, okay, so somebody who's not with the, and I don't know, I don't want to use the term gay agenda, because I know that that's a lot of times taken as being offensive. So I don't exactly, but essentially anything that your group would be advocating for, essentially, and encouraging gay and lesbian youth to fully embrace that and to live that lifestyle. And I don't know if your group takes a position on gay marriage or not, but I would assume that it is affirmative if there is one. So in terms of people who do not agree with you but who are, like I said, of good faith, is there anything about that that where you get where they're coming from even if you don't agree with it? Or from your perspective, is it kind of inherently bigoted if somebody is not with you on this and basically along with whatever it is that you're advocating?
Gotcha. Well, I think the work that I do, which I think has made me as successful as I am, is that I don't come to any work assuming that there is a right or wrong or that there is a good or bad, right? Just because I don't know everything, and I'm sure the person who I'm talking to isn't, right? I mean, doesn't either. So what I really try to do is engage everyone in a conversation, you know?
Okay.
So if you have a difference of opinion than me, I'm like, okay, great. You know, like how do we now sit down and have a thoughtful, respectful conversation where there's a chance where both of us can actually grow, you know? I'm never going to assume that I know more than you and you know more than me, but what I can assume is that if we both listen, there's a chance, you know, that we both can walk away going, wow, you know what, I learned something today, I experienced something in a different way, and then there's a shift in consciousness where we can both find a common ground, right?
Okay.
I'm also knowing that, you know, being raised in America, we're all exposed to, you know, racism and sexism and homophobia and all those things. And because those ideologies are so present amongst them all, we all have that inside of us. So who am I to judge you or to tell you that what you're thinking is or isn't wrong? But what I can do is show up in your life and other people's lives as a loving presence and to remove this idea that I'm here to judge you, because, you know, as my partner always says, it's not that we can't judge, it's that we shouldn't.
Okay, well, yeah, I like that as an answer, because, again, I know that there's a lot fundamentally about the worldview of somebody like myself and somebody like you that is incompatible, but it doesn't mean that, yeah, there can't be a respectful conversation and ways to try to understand more about other people. I like that as an answer. In terms of spelling out any of your particular philosophies and experiences, I had received a note that indicated from my producer that you might be doing a book project here at some point. Is that something that is in the works?
Yes. It keeps changing because the work that I do keeps changing as well. When I first started thinking about doing the book, I was working at an organization that catered to services to LGBTQ youth, right? So the book was really going to be about my experiences as an athlete and then the ways that young people had impacted me. Now I'm starting, you know, I'm the executive director of You Can Play. I'm doing a lot of work with professional sports leagues. So the book is constantly evolving, and I don't think my life's book has been written yet enough that I'm ready to sit down and go, okay, like, let's get a book done. Because I really, if I do want a book, I only want to do one. I would say a book is probably a year to a year and a half off to really where I feel like I'm ready to tell my story in a way that not only kind of heals myself, but heals others and kind of, you know, builds a bridge so people can go, wow, you know, like this story of Wade Davis, it's not just a story of him, but it's a story of me as well.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. We've talked to folks before on the show who've written books or who've contemplated it, but the notion of not feeling ready to do one yet because of not knowing the life experiences that may lie ahead, I think that's the first time I've ever gotten that variety of that answer. So it's definitely an interesting perspective, and with the twists and turns that your life has taken, I can understand that. You want to see what's around the next bend, maybe the one after that, before you do. So. Again, just proving that there's always a lot of different answers possible to the whole book question here. But, all the best to you, Wade. Really appreciate you making time for us on the show today. Thank you very much for the conversation.
No problem at all, and you have a good day.
All right, thanks. Take care.